This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Brian McDonald has taught at Jordan High School in Durham for 13 years, but it wasn't until he went to get his graduate degree at NC Central that he started exploring the history of Jordan. He'd always been fascinated by issues of race and class, and when he delved into the school's past, he discovered a rich story of racial struggle buried within. He's turned his research into a book. It's called Not the End, But the Beginning, The Impact of Race and Class on the History of Jordan High School, and he is here to talk about it today. Brian McDonald, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate being here.
Jordan opened its school, its doors in 1963. Tell us about that and that particular year for that school.
I will. After Brown v. Board of Education in 1954, legally integrated schools, we were two separate school systems, Durham City Schools and Durham Public Schools. And Durham City Schools, characterized by the relationship between Hillside High School and Durham High School. In Durham County, it was a little different. Durham County had Southern High School and Northern High School that opened in 1954 and 55, respectively. And there was also Merrick Moore High School, which was the all-black high school in Durham County. Jordan opens up in 63 in southwest Durham. There's no school there, but there's a need based on parents' reaction, based on the community, based on the Board of Education for a school in that area. And so they decided to open Jordan in its current location in 1963. And what I found out doing the research for the thesis and then the book is that it opens up as the first desegregated school in the county. African-American families were not going to send their students, for the most part, to Southern High School or Northern because of the distance. Also Southern at the time, they were known as the Southern Rebels, and they flew the Dixie flag at every event that they had. And so two African-American students end up attending Jordan in 1963 when the school opens, and as a result, we open up as the first desegregated school.
Now, 1954 was the decision. It's 1963, and this is the first desegregated school. So how is the city and county getting around that?
The city and the county, it's a great question. Durham High School will actually integrate through token integration, meaning a handful of African-American students, in 1957. Joycelyn McKissick and a few others will integrate Durham High School, which is a significant event in Durham City School history. Most other communities are getting around it through freedom of choice plans, through the Pearsall plan, through just straight-up discrimination.
So parents, it's still going on. And when you talk about Jordan being integrated, sort of, integrated how? This is an interesting finding.
Integration in your book. It's a bad word to use. I don't mean bad. It's not a bad word, but it's a wrong word to describe the process at the time. And I found that out in one of my early interviews. I asked one African-American student, I said, oh, well, what did it feel like to integrate Jordan? And they said, no, you've made a mistake. The school was not integrated when I attended. And I learned a valuable lesson that I probably should have already known as a history teacher, that we as a school were desegregated. It was a desegregation. It was tokenism.
Yeah. Maybe about four. How many
black students? We had two. When the school first opened, we had two.
Black students. Right.
Two black students. And then as the school progressed in its early years, I think by 1969, we only had 18 African-American students. And so it was a small population, but some of it was through choice. And some African-American students didn't want to attend Jordan, even though it was desegregated.
What was it like for that handful of African-American students when it opened?
In conversations with some of the first black students to attend, it was everything from they came to school in fear. They felt isolated. One of the most intense interviews I had with a student, in fact, the first African-American female student to be named one of the school's most 10 most outstanding seniors in 1967. She came in the second class, and she said that she had no desire to attend Jordan. Her father hated white people. And I said, well, then why on earth did you attend? And she said, and this was not her father's original quote, but was what he said, that the white man's ice was colder, that the resources were better, and that's what his daughter was going to have. And he knew it. He didn't like it, but he knew it. But the consequences included isolation, included fear, included a lot of day-to-day discrimination, racism, harassment. It was not generally a positive experience those first few years, but it was also, I would argue, a quiet experience because there were so few African-American students that there wasn't much resistance. There wasn't much feedback, much comment. And when there was, it was oftentimes dismissed as irrelevant.
And that calm period didn't last a long time. Eventually, the tensions rose, right?
Eventually, they did, yeah. For our school, I argue for our school, 1969 was the turning point. And for that matter, Durham County, 1969 was the turning point. There was a court case that came out of Mississippi called Alexander v. Holmes, which I had never heard of before I started doing the research. And it said that all dual systems must be eliminated, meaning black and white systems must be eliminated. And so for us, that meant black and white county schools must be integrated. Black and white city schools must be integrated. Well, one of the things Durham County does to solve this or to sort of adhere to this ruling in 69 is they simply closed down Merrick Moore High School, the all-black high school in the county. The consequence of that is most of the African-American students that attended Merrick Moore now attend Jordan because, again, they weren't going to go to Southern. They weren't going to go to Northern. And what you see in our school is we go from 18 students, 18 African-American students, 3% of our student body, to 142 African-American students, 18% of our student body in a single year. And the consequences of that, both positive and negative, transform our school in the early 1970s.
So give us an idea what happened in that first year.
Well, everything in 1969, the first demonstration to take place at our school by African-American students happened as a result of the 1969 homecoming court. It was all white, and African-American students didn't like that. And they staged what I would argue was the first protest in our school, where they refused to leave the front office and wanted to meet with the principal and wanted black representation on the homecoming court and wouldn't leave until they had a conversation of how to do that. And so by the end of the day, it's quote-unquote resolved when the principal at the time agrees to a special vote of African-American students, one black representative from each grade at the time, and then a special vote among those three. The winner of that vote is then awarded a spot on the homecoming court. As a teacher of history, I love that idea of protest and challenge, and that was the first event of 6 years that helped to transform our school.
How about parents? Were they getting involved as well?
I think first you saw it from students. I think over time you saw it from parents. There was in 1970 a teacher stabbed on campus, ended up being stabbed 18 times in the hallway by trespassers. The trespassers were African American. The teacher was white. He said it was not a racial incident, but it was impossible to explain that away given the time period. We had a protest at Enloe where our cheerleaders were attacked. And so in 1973, you start to see more parent involvement where an organization known as the African Dance Group want to have a performance. That performance is denied. The result of that is they march throughout the hall singing "We Shall Overcome" and challenging the principal's denial of that event. They eventually have the event at night after much compromise. And parents after that event begin to voice their concerns that there's little outlet for African-American voices. And that will lead to the first black humanities class at Jordan High School. The next year, it will lead to the first black administrator being hired at Jordan High School. And I think a lot of what began as student frustration turned into parent frustration, community response. And then you saw a shift in, I think, our school culture at the time.
Tell us who you talked to and interviewed for this book.
I surveyed 1,500 alumni. About 300 of them responded to the survey and had the opportunity to do face-to-face interviews with 65 individuals, alumni, former faculty, former administrators, both black and white. And their experiences tell the book. I mean, it's a history book. It's a narrative of the school's history, but it's driven by primary sources. It's driven by oral history. I mean, it truly is a story, and it's their story.
And it's interesting to think about high school kids becoming engaged in a movement in this way, whether they like it or not.
Right.
I mean, this can, in many ways, help students at that age organize, understand the stakes, and in terms of their citizenship, I would think certainly strengthen and bolster their sense of what it means to be an American, to be able to speak out and to bring about change.
Yeah, without question. I don't know that, and I could be wrong here, but I don't know that at the time they knew they were in the middle of
right.
it. I mean, this happens a lot throughout history that you don't necessarily know you're in the middle of a movement. I interviewed high school students, former high school students, who when I put the when the book came out and they read the book and saw part of their story in it, their response was one of surprise, not of criticism, but just that I would characterize their activities as the transformative time period in our school. But when looking at the timeline, I saw it no other way, that they changed the trajectory of our school. They didn't see it that way, right, just based on their 1 year, 2 years, 3 years of activity. But without a doubt, they participated in a movement, whether they knew it or not.
How did you come to write this book?
It's a great question, and it's not one I even wanted to write. I did it as my thesis for my graduate degree, and I've always been interested in topics that deal with race and class. I always have. I teach a race-related class on campus called Minority Studies. In fact, it was born out of the Black Humanities class I talk about in the book, which is an honor to teach. I teach a class called Poverty in America that I created for the district. And so I've always had interest there.
To be clear, you did not create poverty.
I did not create poverty. I created the course okay. Poverty in America for our school district. No. And so in working with my thesis committee, in taking classes at NCCU, my advisors recommended that I do a history of Jordan. And I was appalled at the very idea. Hmm. I said, no, I can't do it. And they asked me, why on earth wouldn't you? Because you've been working there for so long. You talk about it all the time. It's clearly a passion. And my idea was that I couldn't work there all day, grade all night, and then interview people about the school's history on the weekend. That's a little too much Jordan. I mean, it was just the thought of it was not something I could get on board with. And I mentioned the idea to a couple of folks, to the president of our alumni association, to some early alumni. And they said, oh, Brian, let me tell you this story. Oh, let me tell you this story. Did you hear about this? And about four or five stories in, I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked because it was an amazing story and an amazing narrative. And I had to go back to my advisors and just apologize and say, I take it back. I actually want to do that story. But I still want to do it through the lens of race and class. And they were thrilled.
We've talked about race, but class does play an important part in your book. Tell us about it.
It does. You know, I argue that class dominates the early 60s. You know, our school opens up in 63, and until 69, until the Holmes decision, Alexander V. Holmes, I argue that it's class that's the driving force, not race. And not because there weren't racial issues, but because the numbers didn't balance out. There wasn't enough voice for protest. The majority was too much of a majority to allow for a chance for minority response in our school. The consequence of that is Hope Valley, which has been traditionally the upper-class white community, oftentimes drove the decisions that were made. And that community and the involvement of parents led to the direction of our school. And there was oftentimes competition, if you can call it that, between folks that lived in Hope Valley and folks that lived everywhere else. And it was over materialism. It was over sort of the any power that can exist. It was over the power of sort of the decisions that were made. And so it was during that time period, I would argue, socioeconomic status drove both the tensions and the decision-making. And then once again, 1977 and beyond, that reemerges as class and materialism and tracking and educational decisions and relationships between students and faculty that once again sort of drives the issue. Because by that point, race, which had been in the early 70s the driving factor, as I argue, subsides because students of different races had been going to school for over a decade by that point. And by that point, it becomes less of the driving issue.
Was Jordan different, or how was Jordan different from other high schools at the time?
I think we share a lot of qualities that other high schools had as far as issues of race, as far as issues of class. I think many other schools, especially in the American South, had these racial issues or racial tensions, transformations, if you will, in the 50s and the 60s as a result of the Brown decision. So I think for us, we're unique in the sense that our transformation comes in the early 1970s. But a lot of schools and folks that have read the book have made that comment, that sounds a lot like my high school. That sounds a lot like where I come from. So I think that it's a story that exists around the country. The individuals are different. The experiences are somewhat the same, based on the time period.
It makes you think that, you know, if you think about the fact that parents and students are engaged in this problem, whether they wanted to or not, whether they were politically inclined or not, they're now involved in this thing in a way that they might not be if it was simply an issue that was being taken on by the city council or other governing bodies. So is there a way that the struggle at Jordan transformed politics in Durham, or at least contributed to a change in politics, or was it just part of the overall change taking place at that time?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. I think it's part of the overall change taking place at the time. I don't know that we as a single school drove the change in politics, but I know that, you know, we always talk in Durham about the Durham City-Durham County merger of 1992 as the merger, and it's a relevant part of our history. But I argue it's not the first merger. We describe it, we talk about it as the merger. I think the first merger happened back in 1969, 1970, when the dual systems were eliminated. I think that's the true first merger. In fact, I argue that in the book. But I think we're part of many stories that lead to then the Durham City-County merger and that sort of impact race relations today.
That merger and you're talking about, relations. Of course, is the school system.
Absolutely, the Durham City schools and Durham County schools.
So what brought you to Jordan High School in the first place?
It was a great accident. I went to Elon College for my undergraduate degree. I'm originally from Connecticut. I came down here for school, thought that I would go back and teach somewhere up in Connecticut, but fell in love with North Carolina, fell in love with the area, wanted to teach at a school that was diverse, had the opportunity to interview at Jordan back in 2001. They hired me, and I haven't looked back since. I've been at Jordan since then. It's one of the most diverse, I would argue the most diverse school in Durham.
Well, how are things there now?
I think things there are great. I say that selfishly as a current faculty member that things are great. I think we've come a great way from the stories that I write about in the book. I had the opportunity to let the minority studies class I teach read the conclusion of the book. Or the original conclusion, I should say, that students in the minority studies class disagreed with at the time. I made the point in the original conclusion that, to oversimplify the original point, that all the problems were solved. And they pointed out that I was wrong and that I should look a little further. And it was good for students to be open and honest and to criticize. And they invited me to athletic contests and to other things going on in the school to see what hadn't changed.
And what hasn't changed?
Well, they invited me to a basketball game and went to a basketball game. And my point was, well, our teams are diverse. We've changed drastically. It's a diverse school. And so they invited me to the game and they said, well, watch where you sit. And if you come and you see an athletic contest at our school, either on the football field or on the basketball court, the audience is very segregated. If you come to the high school cafeteria, the cafeteria is very segregated. If you come to, sadly, a staff meeting, our staff meetings are segregated. So there's still self-segregation that occurs. And this is not unique to Jordan. I think this is, based on some of the other schools I've been in, this is happening all over the country, certainly all over North Carolina, that self-segregation continues to sort of permeate our culture. You see that in classes. I mean, if you walk down the hall and you see a class that's predominantly African-American or Hispanic, it's safe to assume, for all the wrong reasons, that that's a standard level class.
Well, how about your minority studies class? Is it
the minority studies class I teach and the poverty in America class I teach are the most diverse classes I have at the school. And I think you'll see that in the electives on campus, that those are the most diverse, both from an academic standpoint, from a demographic standpoint. And that's one of the reasons I love teaching those classes, is the perspective is different every day. For the first time, I've been teaching AP classes at the school for the last 10 years. And for the first time this year, I have more minority students than majority students, which I'm thrilled to see, but has not historically been the trend at our school or other schools.
Brian, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Brian McDonald is the author of Not the End, But the Beginning, The Impact of Race in Class on the History of Jordan High School. We're going to take a break, and then there's more of the state of things. Stay with us.